If you like to take in the Jazz on the Grand performances, one is scheduled for tonight, and an hour or thereabouts ago, it was cloudy outside and looked kind of threatening here, but the clouds are supposed to go away, so you should be able to take in tonight's performance. Saxophonist Phil Denny, a local guy who's performed a couple of times here on Current State, as it turns out, is set to go tonight at Lansing City Market for Jazz on the Grand. This is Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thank you for being here. The Michigan State Board of Education is poised to make a controversial vote today. For months, the board's been grappling with creating a set of guidelines aimed at protecting the rights and safety of transgender students. The document would address a number of issues, from restroom access to counseling services. Over the summer, officials have gathered some 13,000 public comments on its way toward drafting a series of voluntary actions for local school districts. Now, the plan has both supporters and opponents. We'll hear from both sides today. First, a supporter, Nathan Triplett, is a familiar name here in mid-Michigan, former mayor of East Lansing. He's now the policy and political action director for the LGBTQ advocacy group Equality Michigan. Nathan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Equality Michigan's been closely watching the evolution of the state board's written guidelines. Now, the language of the document has changed quite a bit, I believe, in the last few months. Can you talk to us about these revisions and what you make of them?
Yeah, well, to start off, I would say that this has been an iterative process that we've gone through putting these guidelines together, but the goal has remained the same throughout, and that was helping provide resources to school districts to create safe learning environments for all students, regardless of their sexual orientation and gender identity. In the course of that process, a number of issues were raised. Folks were concerned about how parents fit into this process. Folks were concerned about making sure there was really clear guidance around some of the key questions that our educators are asking across Michigan, and I think that this revised version helps take a lot of that feedback into response and has put together a document that is comprehensive, research-based, and while voluntary, will definitely provide administrators, teachers, parents across the state who are concerned about school safety with the resources they need to make sure that those safe learning environments are something they're able to provide.
What is your understanding in terms of the relationships here involving parents? I know critics, and Doug Levesque will probably, I'm sure he will bring this up, that parents have been kind of removed from some of the conversations here, or that's what's feared anyway. What do you make of that? Those revisions?
Yeah, I think any fair reading of this document would show that parents are at the center of the consideration here, as they should be. Our organization, Equality Michigan, proponents of this policy, have said from day one that the ideal situation is to have parents who are actively involved and supportive of their child as they're going through a coming out process or as they're encountering difficulties at school. But we're also willing to acknowledge that there are extenuating circumstances, unfortunately, at times where it may be unsafe to share certain information with parents and that school districts can't be put in the place of putting those children at risk. Remember, 40% of homeless youth in this country are LGBT identified, and part of the reason for that is when information it becomes available to parents that and they're not supportive of their child's coming out process and that results in them being removed from their home and ending up having to fend for themselves, that's obviously something that should be deeply troubling to everyone. And we just have to take account of that possibility, which is exactly what the policy does. It says that the default should be parents are deeply involved, but in those extenuating circumstances where it could create a safety issue, that has to be taken into consideration as well.
And the net result of that in some cases could be that school administrators know that a young person identifies as gay or lesbian, let's say, and the parents may not know. So people in the school administration could know, and the parents might not know.
Yeah, we should just note there, that is not a unique situation. There's all sorts of information that schools are aware of on a day-to-day basis that's happening at school that they're not sharing
with
parents.
I'm sure you're right. We're talking about an impending vote by the State Board of Education on a set of revised guidelines pertaining to transgender students. Nathan Triplett's the former mayor of East Lansing. He's now policy and political action director for the group Equality Michigan. A lot of this debate here and nationally has been over restrooms and whether to allow LGBTQ students to use the restroom corresponding to the gender to which they identify rather than the one they were assigned at birth. How might this impact non-LGBTQ students who might be uncomfortable with sharing restroom or locker room facilities?
Well, what the policy says is that everyone is entitled to the using a restroom with safety and privacy in mind. And if there is a student who is uncomfortable with the possibility of a trans student using a restroom or locker room facility, that an accommodation has to be made for them. So I should note that this is nothing new, what's being proposed here. Trans folks have been using restrooms aligned with their gender identity for many years. What this policy does is make a recommendation about best practice, but it doesn't change the lived reality in our schools or our communities across the country. And it does take into account, as I said, the fact that some folks may feel uncomfortable with that. And if they do, then an option has to be provided for them where they feel like they can use the facilities in safety and privacy as well. But that option can't come at the expense of the safety or privacy or best interest of transgender students.
Some number of people have advocated single bathrooms that any individual can use for any reason. And often these people claim this is a pretty simple way to sidestep a lot of the disagreement that's in play here. And I'm fairly sure that quite a few school districts, some number of school districts, already have this in play. Is that a way forward here to an extent in your view?
Well, there's certainly nothing wrong with single-user restrooms, and as you point out, they're widely available. Where it becomes problematic is when an individual is forced to use a segregated facility like that. And while it may seem like common sense up front oftentimes to say, well, trans folks will just use this separate single-user facility, the reality is in a school setting, what that does is it forces a student to disclose their trans identity and may make them a target for even more harassment and abuse than they were already subject to. So while well-intentioned, it has some really unfortunate consequences. But again, you know, our organization's position, and I think the position of most people, is gender-neutral restrooms or single-user restrooms are a fine alternative, but they're not available everywhere, and we do have to deal with a situation where a district or a school may not have those facilities available, and then ultimately leave it up to the student or other individuals who are in the school about what facility works best for them.
I understand that Michigan's guidelines actually predate those that the federal government has issued. In July, Attorney General Bill Schuette of Michigan joined a multi-state lawsuit seeking to get the federal guidelines overturned. If that effort were successful, how might school districts that adopt the state's LGBTQ guidelines, how might they be affected?
The short answer is it shouldn't be affected at all. These guidelines that are being worked on by the state are voluntary, non-binding recommendations on best practice. The state is not arguing that the guidelines have the force of law, but they're saying to districts who have asked repeatedly for this guidance, here's what you can do to help create a safe learning environment. So regardless of what happens with the federal litigation that's challenging the Obama administration's guidelines on the rights of transgender students, the document that's being considered by the state board today can and should stand and should still be regarded as best practice for creating safe learning environments. The question in the federal lawsuits is not, is this a smart policy? The question is, who has the power to decide, and was the proper procedure followed?
The state or the feds?
And within the federal government, did the U.S. Department of Education and Justice follow the proper procedure in promulgating their guidance? And I should also note, though I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, that the guidelines issued by the federal government are consistent with longstanding legal precedent in courts, including the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Michigan, finding that sex discrimination includes discrimination based on gender identity. So lots of misinformation out there about it, but what your listeners need to know is it doesn't matter what happens with those federal lawsuits. It won't change the fact that these guidelines are comprehensive research-based best practices that will help create safe schools, and people should do it because it's the right thing, not legally mandated.
Nathan Triplett is the Policy and Political Action Director for Equality Michigan. His organization's watching the actions of the Michigan State Board of Education, which is set to vote on a set of guidelines dealing with the rights and safety of LGBTQ students. Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you.
Now we'll hear from a differing opinion on the state board's guidelines. Joining us now by phone, Douglas Levesque. Douglas is the founder and director of the Bible Nation Society based in Owosso. Mr. Levesque, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about your group's interest in these LGBTQ guidelines and a little bit about the Bible Nation Society.
Yeah, Bible Nation Society can be accessed at BibleNationSingular.org. We have numerous policy pieces where we believe that, you know, 3,500 years of Judeo-Christian precedent and the Bible have a positive effect on society, and of course is part of the important heritage here in Michigan and in our nation. We got involved several years ago with the Elliot Larson fight over allowing homosexual marriage to be a civil right. And, of course, we oppose that. We feel, even though there's a lot of talk by our previous speaker about the normalcy of homosexuality and gender identity being something that's normal and legal, and he says the right thing to do, he's creating a new morality. And we oppose that, and because of that, we've been involved in the issues here with the school board. I'm in the Hanna building right now waiting for the meeting. And fortunately, unfortunately, because of our voice of opposition and the success we've had in opposing these issues, been invited to run for the school board, and I'm now running for the Michigan School Board.
Okay. So now, supporters of the guidelines like Equality Michigan and Nathan Triplett talk about the high incidence of bullying and abuse inflicted on LGBTQ students, which consequently, they say, factors into suicide rates and homelessness. Do you see any merit in the guidelines as a deterrent to those forces?
You know, I've worked on suicide prevention boards. I've been a pastor in the state for 25 years and, you know, obviously have worked with both homosexual, transgender peoples, hermaphroditic peoples, and their issues. And like anything, if you are going to have some sort of aberrant presentation of yourself to society, you're going to subject yourself to differing opinions, and some of those will be negative. I think just like we've seen sometimes urban-on-urban crime, we can't blame necessarily all gun owners for urban crime when it's oftentimes urban-on-urban. And I think a lot of this homosexual community violence and transgender violence, like we saw in Orlando, is perpetrated by themselves and by their struggling mental issues with the issues that they're having. So it's not that we're not sympathetic. There's no hate involved here. I just think it's a dangerous precedent to normalize LGBTQ policy and then impose it upon students, to where students are kind of forced to be in an environment where this is the norm and they have to deal with it. It's discrimination in reverse.
I know you feel that the schools are on the verge of erasing parental rights here. Could you talk to us a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, initially, I think these policies were kind of tried to be slipped through. And no matter how they're presented, this was a premeditated effort by the LGBT community. You know, they like to say that it was schools asking for help and that they're just guidelines. But, you know, ultimately, your child could go to school and be taught and surrounded by this gender confusion, identify themselves as gender confused, then get some sort of counseling steering them in a direction without the parents' notification. And the only change in the new policy, after thousands and thousands of people have spoken on this end, is that, well, of course we'll involve the parents on a case-by-case basis. And we find that to be really strong statism and, you know, the schools involving themselves in that. And so this policy guidelines affects 1.5 million students and most homes in Michigan. And we feel like it's, you know, inserting, ramrodding even LGBTQ policy down our children's throat and really taking away parental involvement, parental rights. They say they've included that, but Richard Zeeley of the school board currently has said that these revisions weren't even given to him on the school board. He hasn't even didn't have the opportunity to see these revisions and all the 13,000, you know, comments. That he never got to see any of those.
Okay.
And so this we feel like this is a ramrodded re-document, and I read it, and there's really no changes in here regarding parental policy.
We are talking about an impending vote by the State Board of Education on a set of revised guidelines pertaining to transgender students. Doug Levesque is the founder and director of Bible Nation Society, headquartered in Owosso. Douglas, gay marriage is the law of the land. People's attitudes across the country and arguably around the world have changed profoundly with regard to the rights and the treatment of LGBTQ people. What do you say to critics who say you are simply on the wrong side of history?
Well, yeah, 3,500 years of Judeo-Christian ethic has said that this is aberrant behavior, and we'll continue to say so. It's really not the law of the land. The Supreme Court upheld in a Burgessel decision, not making law, but upholding the concept of personal identity. And I and others certainly have the right, and certainly public school students and parents have the right to identify, say, as Christian, to identify, say, as supporting traditional marriage. So we'll continue this fight, and that kind of rhetoric doesn't really mean anything, you know, to me in the continuance of the argument. And go ahead.
All right. Well, we're just about out of time. We got maybe a few more seconds for you to say something here. Continue.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'd like people to consider me for the school board. Elect Levesque, LEVESQUE.com, gives my policy pieces. I've written half a dozen policy pieces about education in general, not just the LGBT transgender guidelines. I do think there are other answers and other stances that we could take. I think this is setting a dangerous precedent. This exact policy and guideline verbiage in the state of Massachusetts and Iowa has turned into total public policy, now even affecting churches. So this kind of verbiage will affect all public policy. This is a Trojan horse used in our schools to affect the rest of government and use the argument, hey, that it's the law of the land. And so this is a religious liberty issue as well.
All right, we'll leave it there. Douglas Levesque is the founder and director of Bible Nation Society based in Owosso. We've been talking about the State Board of Education's impending vote on a set of guidelines addressing the rights and safety of LGBTQ students. Mr. Levesque, thank you.
Thank you for it.
Coming up on Current State, Hannah's House of Lansing provides homeless, expectant mothers with shelter and support so they can gain the strength they need to raise their child or pursue an adoption plan if they choose. For Neighbors in Action, we'll speak with staff members of Hannah's House about their work. That's coming up on Current State. This Sunday at 3 p.m. at MSU's Fairchild Theater, the strong musical history of the Beaumont Brass teams with the mighty brass of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra in the Sonic Showcase Brassworks. WKAR's Peter Wharf met earlier this week with the Beaumont's Ava Ordman, Philip Cinder, and Corbin Wagner. Cinder sets up the conversation, noting the diverse mix of music for quintet and larger works, such as the electrifying 10th Symphony by Dmitri Shostakovich.
There are arrangements of pieces for other mediums that we're doing for brass and percussion. So in this case, it's a full orchestral score that we're reducing to about 20 brass and 3 or 4 percussion. And so, of course, we have to cover the woodwind parts and the string parts, and it's pretty challenging. Luckily, the piece is only 3 minutes of whirlwind activity.
The arrangement was done by Tim Higgins, who is principal trombone of the San Francisco Symphony, and it was just done last year for Northwestern University's alumni event concert. And he arranged it, and a bunch of alumni came back and played it. And that's where I first heard about it and saw a little blurb of it on YouTube. And I went, wow, it's really an exciting, amazing piece and a great arrangement.
How does it work for brass only and a few percussion, too?
Well, we haven't tried it yet, so we'll see. It's what I heard in that recording, and the feedback from people that played it is that it's very effective.
You have a mix of works that originally for brass quintet and then arrangements as well. How typical is this concert of that sort of mix?
I think it's right on the mark with what we tend to typically do. Brass instruments are so good at playing a lot of different styles of music, and so we tend to borrow from voices from other instruments, and of course there's a lot of original pieces that are just incredible, and so two of those original pieces will be present on this concert.
We're trying to perform some unusual pieces that are for an entire ensemble, a band piece, an orchestra piece, and those of course we need to have arrangements, and so we really believe the brass can handle it beautifully. It's just a fresh sound to an already established piece of music.
We are very excited, though, about doing a world premiere on this concert by one of our new composers, David Biedenbender.
So that's a Spartan fanfare.
Yes, the Spartan fanfare. That'll start the second half.
Can you kind of give us a little bit of a preview on what to listen for in this world premiere?
Well, it's a world premiere for all of us. So until we play it, we've heard a MIDI of it, I think. But that's about it. I know the trombone glisses all the way through.
It does look like an incredibly high-energy, effective piece to start the second half of the program.
In your view or in your listening, is there anything that's particularly Spartan about it?
We're all going to be wearing Sparty outfits.
I don't think so. I think it's more, you know, David's our new composer, and he's a true Spartan for sure, and that's why he named it Spartan Fanfare.
This is Peter Worf for Current State on WKAR. I'm speaking with members of the Beaumont Brass Quintet about their concert coming up entitled Brassworks this Sunday at Fairchild Theater here at MSU. This is a group that's been around since 1989. So you've seen a lot of personnel changes over the years. But what would you say are sort of some of the common benchmarks? I guess one of them has been bringing along students who are at a higher level as part of the group.
Oh, exactly true. Right, in a brass quintet, there are two trumpets, and so our trumpet teacher has been joined by a talented graduate student most of the time, although for a couple of years we had a really strong undergraduate student who was a member of the Beaumont Brass, whose name is Taga Larson. He was a member of the group about 20 years ago and is now a trumpet section member in the Chicago Symphony.
And joined them about 10, 12 years back.
Right. So it's been fun for us to rotate through a number of second trumpet players, joining Rich Illman for his 25 years and now Justin Emmerich for the last 2 years.
What are some of the most important elements of chamber music playing, brass quintet playing, versus maybe orchestral playing?
We try to match style, match sound, and we try to make every phrase into great music. And so when we first listen to a piece, we find our bearing, we figure out how our parts work together, when are we important, when are we part of the texture only. Mm-hmm. And we then try to listen to recordings, and we amplify what we've learned from that. And hopefully by the end of the result, we'll have a kind of an individual Beaumont Brass version of a standard repertoire.
One of the most recognized pieces might be Percy Grainger's Lincolnshire Posy on the program. You also have a well-known vocal piece by Morten Lauridsen, O Magnum Mysterium. Do you think a lot about sounding more vocal when you're playing a work like the Lauridsen?
Absolutely. Just to sort of jump on the bandwagon here about the brass quintet music versus our orchestra playing and so forth, we have to do so many more different things, especially when you talk about transcriptions where, you know, if we have a tuba playing a viola part in the Shostakovich, we're all playing woodwind parts and a variety of other things. Very little do we play the part that we normally would play in Lincolnshire Posy. Occasionally, I recognize that, those 8 bars I play, but the rest is... I think the bass trombone plays bassoon part in one of the movements at the opening. And it's not just how do we play our brass instruments, how do we imitate the instruments that we're playing in order to pull off a piece like Lincolnshire Posy.
What's it like to be bringing to MSU some of your DSO colleagues?
It's always great to play with some of the nation's best soloists. Carl Pittick, he just released a new CD of a brand new concerto. He did the world premiere, I believe, and He's as good a soloist as you'll find in the whole country. And Ken Tompkins on trombone is equal to that as well. This wonderful soloist. And thankfully, they're not only great soloists, they're our friends. And so we love to play with them just as buddies, as much as we do love hearing their beautiful approach to their instruments.
Brass Works this Sunday at the Fairchild Theater at Michigan State University as Beaumont Brass and friends come together. Ava, Corbin, and Phil, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And coming up on Current State, imagine going under the Mackinac Bridge to install new sensors. Do you need experience for that sort of thing?
The only thing I did is bungee jumping from a couple of bridges.
Coming up, a serious look at how MSU research could lead to better monitoring of the condition of Michigan bridges. That's coming up on Current State. Stay close. Current State on WKAR. Back on Monday, we talked with two guests about proposed marijuana regulations in Michigan, which were passed last week by the state Senate. One Current State online listener added the following comments. It's good that these bills recognize the legitimacy of marijuana dispensaries, but they also pay off the state police, longstanding critics of Michigan's Medical Marijuana Act, with pant loads of additional employment for safeguarding transportation of marijuana, safeguarding in quotes. Shouldn't the bills also include forfeiture reform, long a cash cow for the police? Is there no limit to the amount of money which the state police need? You're welcome to weigh in anytime. You can do that online at WKAR.org, where everything we do ends up. And you can also email us anytime with any kind of feedback or comment on what you hear on Current State. It's currentstate@wkar.org. By the way, we hear the House, the State House, could vote on the marijuana measures as early as today. Hannah's House in Lansing is a homeless shelter with a very specific goal: to provide pregnant homeless women not just with food and shelter, but with resources, support, and encouragement so that when they leave, they have everything they need to face the future. Joining us this morning in the studio is the executive director of Hannah House, Deanna Arnett. Deanna, welcome.
Good morning.
Lindsay Morgan is going to join us here in just a few minutes. Lindsay was a resident at Hannah's House some years ago. Deanna, what criteria do women have to meet to qualify for the program?
Homelessness and pregnant is the criteria for the program. They also are required to drug test before coming into the program and to make a minimum of a 3-month commitment.
And tell us a little bit more about what you provide. What's the bread and butter of what you do at Hannah's House?
We're a homeless shelter, but we're also a program. So during the time that the women are there, they are required to attend life skills education. So that includes relationships classes, budgeting classes, parenting classes, nutrition classes, and also we're Christian-based. So they attend church on Sundays, daily devotions, and weekly Bible studies.
How do most women find you?
Really through networking. We partner with other agencies in the area, and when you're homeless, you're directed through 211 or through calling agencies in the area, and we know the criteria for placement and each other's agencies and are able to refer homeless people as needed.
What's the median age of the woman that you help? What the age range, let's say? What's the age range there?
I would say 18 years of age. You have to be 18 to enter the program, and then it's childbearing age. So as long as you're pregnant, you can enter the program.
Okay.
Right.
Lindsay Morgan was a resident at Hannah's House years ago. She joins us now. Welcome to Current State.
Hello.
Take us back to about 9 years ago. Tell us what was going on in your life then.
Oh, my life was a mess. I was actually sleeping in a vacant apartment. Not the ideal situation to bring a child into the world. I think it was me calling 411 that brought me to Hannah's house. It's a number that people can call, and they'll give you resources for any, pretty much anything that you have a problem with in your life. That's how I got in contact with Hannah's house, and I entered the house at about 6 weeks of my pregnancy, and I stayed there until my daughter was about 3 to 4 months old.
Mm. How, and you, okay, until she was 3 or 4 months old. Tell us about your stay. What, how would you describe everything that happened during your stay at Hannah's house?
It was so comfortable, so welcome, so welcoming. Everybody there made me feel at home. It gave me a sense of stability, and it made me feel safe, and it alleviated all the stress that I had. I was provided with numerous resources that put my mind at ease as far as needing things, necessities for the baby when she was born. Overall, the experience was absolutely wonderful. I kind of would compare it to Grandma's house. It made me feel very comfortable and at peace.
And tell us how you're doing today.
I still have struggles, but one of the main things that I took from Hannah's house was a closer relationship to God, and I found that I still utilize that to this day. You know, a lot of things happen, it's out of my hands, and I pray on a lot of things now, and it seems to always just work out.
And religion was not a part of your life prior
to Hannah's?
I'd always
been Christian, but I never honestly accepted God into my heart. Until I entered Hannah's house. And, you know, they did provide me with a Bible that I have to this day. And it's something that I go to when I feel lost. And it's just a support that's there always and never ending.
How big a family do you have today?
I have 3 children, one of which who just had a baby, so I'm a grandmother.
Well done.
Yeah. And when my daughter found out she was pregnant, you know, she's 15, and although it's scary, I knew that it was possible because of all the resources that I found out that I had through Hannah's house, you know, that we were going to make it, that she didn't have to have an abortion. She didn't have to make any decision that she didn't feel comfortable with. She would always be taken care of, and so would the baby.
I'm speaking with Lindsay Morgan, former resident at Hannah's House, a shelter for pregnant women who are homeless, and with Deanna Arnett, executive director of Hannah's House. How would you like to see Hannah's House grow? Or what does Hannah's House need right now, Deanna?
We run off of 80% donations, so we're always in need of financial donations. I'd like to see our Living Skills program grow. I've had a lot of other agencies in the community inquire about whether we'd offer our Living Skills program to those agencies. And so I've been working personally on building a program that uses research-based curriculum.
And the Living Skills program, is this what you touched on earlier?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, the interpersonal relationships, budgeting, parenting, and nutrition.
And how many women at a time are apt to be residents at Hannah's House?
We house up to 4 women at a time. We're not a large shelter, but it's a really good number. We also serve up to 300 people a year in our Hannah's Attic program, which is a community resource program where we give emergency diapers and formula to the people in the community.
We'll talk a little bit more about the Hannah's Attic program here in just a little bit. Hannah's House is a Christian ministry. If a woman wants to be in the program but isn't a professed Christian, well, you took in Lindsay, so that's obviously not any kind of criteria.
Correct. You don't have to claim yourself as a Christian, but you have to go into the program with a willingness to participate in the required Bible studies and church service and devotions.
Lindsay, you recently got back in contact with Hannah's House because of Hannah's Attic, the diaper program, and your new grandson, and you ended up meeting some of the women who are there now and kind of sharing your story with them. What was that experience like to go back?
I actually had my daughter with me, who's now 7 years old, that I was pregnant with at the time when I lived there. And it was really exciting for her to see where she came home from the hospital. And when I came in, I could just see the looks on their faces. It just reminded me of me. kind of unsurety, and I was told they were newer to the program, and I could kind of tell that they hadn't been there that long. So it was really exciting for me to tell them a little bit about my experience, just to give them some, I don't know, insight on how it feels to be out of Hannah's house,
sure,
after Hannah's house, and what it could honestly do for them in the long run. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was important to touch base, and I think that's why Deanna felt compelled for me to come here to the interview. But I did utilize, my grandson was born 5 weeks early. It was very sudden. My daughter was in the hospital for 20 days. I had to take 2 weeks off of work. And I realized, wow, when he comes home, I don't even have diapers. And then I thought, well, I'll call Hannah's house. So
and
that's
this is what the Hannah's Attic program is about. Can you tell us more about the Hannah's Attic?
Correct. Well, it's a community resource program. So we get a lot of donations and from people who are invested in our ministry, and we get high chairs and pack and plays and cribs and formula and diapers, and anything that comes in, we donate back out to the community. The diaper program is an emergency diaper program, so families can come in once a month for a supply of emergency diapers.
I understand you have a small staff and some interns and volunteers. What needs do you have for volunteers right now?
Right now, we have a small staff of about 4 house managers, and then I have a director of development. Our needs right now in the facility, we have a need for people to come in on Sundays. We have, or on Saturdays, we have self-care Saturdays where the women are invested in really taking care of themselves and developing hobbies and just other activities for personal growth. So, and that's new to the program. And so what we'd like for people to do is people that might have hobbies that they would want to share with the women, whether it's scrapbooking or sewing or just exercise, yoga, pregnancy,
okay,
type classes to come in to offer their skills to the women in the shelter.
Lindsay, we have less than a minute left. What would you like to say to young women who might be in the position you were once in?
There's always an alternative. There's support out there, and you have choices. Don't think that you have no choice at all and that you're alone, because there's people out there that are willing to take you in and to help you, even if you're not going to stay at Hannah's house. They are full of information and resources to help you during your pregnancy, and just be positive and pray and everything will work out.
And get help. It's out there if you seek it, I guess. I've been speaking with Lindsay Morgan, a former resident at Hannah's House Homeless Shelter for Pregnant Women, and with Deanna Arnett, the executive director of Hannah's House. Lindsay, Deanna, thank you for being here. Good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out. Email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State. Tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. It's 90.5 WKAR and Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. A Michigan State University study is aimed at doing a better job of monitoring the condition of American bridges. It starts next week, and Current State Scott Pohl is here with more. Researchers are starting at the state's most iconic bridge, right, Scott?
That's right, Mark. Imagine lowering yourself under the Mackinac Bridge.
Wow.
To install experimental sensors. Well, that's exactly what MSU Associate Professor of Structural Engineering Nizar Lajnev is about to do. He says the idea is to detect potential problems before they happen.
If we're talking about implementing hundreds or even thousands of sensors on a bridge, you cannot ask people to pay $1,000 per unit. So that cost is, and that's what's available in the market right now. So the first idea that we started with is to try to reduce the cost. And with the development that we did here, we were able to reduce it to less, like the projected value would be, the projected cost would be less than $1 per sensor. So we really reduced it a few orders of magnitude.
How did you do that?
That's the new technology.
Okay.
We have few patents. We've been working on this project for quite a few years now. And it started when I was doing my PhD. I did my PhD work here at MSU. And I've been working with Professor of Electrical Engineering, Shantanu Chakrabarty. He's now in University of Washington University in St. Louis.
And also we have few projects with a couple of other universities, including the University of Southern California with Professor Masri. And we have a new project with University of Nevada at Reno to test these sensors on different platforms. And the idea is we came up with a new technology, which is, okay, in the past 20 years, everyone is moving to digital. All the electronics, everything is digital. And we are forgetting about analog. And if you think back in the 70s or even before when everything started, it started with analog electronics. But when you're trying to do something very basic, like reducing the cost or implementing these new sensors, we went back to analog electronics. And if you think just simply about currents, if you're trying to do an addition, like adding two values, if you're doing it in digital electronics, you have to do analog to digital conversion, and then you do the addition, and then you convert back to get the value. If you're thinking analog electronics, what you do is just you put two wires together, two currents are coming, and then they will add, simply add. So that reduces, that really helps reduce the cost when it comes to electronics and other things. So that's what we did. We eliminated everything that is signal processing, digital conversion. We have eliminated the need for batteries, and that's the other thing that's very important that helps drives the cost down, because all available electronics right now, you need to power them. And if you think about batteries, maybe the best that you can get will last 1 to 2 years. And it's impractical for a bridge, again, like the Mackinac Bridge, to have 2,000 sensors and you have to go there every year, replace 2,000 batteries. That's impractical. So we came up with this technology where the sensor is powered by the vibration on the bridge, movement on the bridge. So we eliminated the need for batteries. And with that, all the electronics that are in between the memory where you record the data and the batteries, we eliminated everything. Right now, it connects directly and it transforms vibration or strain into an electrical signal. Then we take that signal directly and we record it on a memory.
How big are these sensors?
The actual electronics themselves, they are just 1 millimeter square, like 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter.
Oh.
That's all you need. And then comes the main part for the size is the antenna for communication and the package. So depending on your application, whether you are trying to implement it on a road or on a bridge, the packaging will be important because you need to protect it from the environment, from temperature, something like the Mackinac Bridge going down to minus 20 C or something.
Mm-hmm.
In winter, you need to protect the electronics. So most of the size will come from that. But the actual electronics and the piezo, they're just a quarter size disc. That's the piezo, and 2 millimeters for the sensor. That's it.
Right now, am I right that bridges are monitored with visual inspections? Yeah. If I'm right about that, how do these sensors improve on that?
First thing is most of these inspections, they are very costly. That's the first thing. If you are relying on visual inspection, it's very costly because you need to send someone there once every year, once every 2 years, inspect every part of the bridge. The second thing is you don't have an objective measurement. You don't have objective data. So you're just looking at a bridge and trying to assess if something is wrong with it. What will the sensors do is they will assist in this monitoring. So first thing, they can reduce the number of inspections that you'll have to do. If you have a continuous stream of data that is coming in, you would only send someone only if you detect something, if the sensors are telling you something is wrong. So that reduces the cost, reduces the personal hour that you have to send people there on the bridge. And also, they will assist by giving you a new type of data. So you're just continuously, all the time, you have an idea about the response of the bridge, whether it's stressed correctly, whether it's overstressed in each and every component. So it's more, it assists you in monitoring the data.
Now, it would sound to the uninitiated like myself that what we are monitoring here is movement on the bridge.
Right.
And I guess I'm curious about whether it differentiates between movements that are related to traffic as opposed to, say, the wind. And does it matter what might be causing the bridge to move?
It doesn't really matter at the end because we are monitoring at the local level. We are monitoring components. For example, we select a connection at the end of the bridge, and then we put sensors around it. So what we are interested in is the response of that connection, how much stress it's observing, whether it's coming from wind or traffic passing over it. What we are interested in is how much strain or stress that component is supporting. And we know the limits because people who design the bridge, they know exactly the limits for stress and strain and everything. so we can directly compare the performance of each and every component to what it's supposed to do, to its design parameters.
Would I be right in guessing that initially it would be setting a baseline, so to speak, and that future measurements right. will be compared to that baseline?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the whole idea with these sensors. That's why we can install them on existing bridges. So they would work with a new bridge, of course. That's the baseline.
Sure.
But, for example, with the Mackinac Bridge, it's been already there for over 58 years. So once we install them, we will have a baseline when it comes to its performance. And then starting from that point, we can compare its response over time to the time when we install it. And we see if there's any degradation in performance or there's any difference. It doesn't have to be a negative. But if we are observing any difference in behavior, we can try to track back and find its origin or the reason that is happening. So that's the idea.
I'm talking with MSU civil and environmental engineer Nizar Lajnev. He soon will be placing sensors on the underside of the Mackinac Bridge in a research project that he hopes will improve on how we monitor the condition of bridges in the U.S. Do you know yet what date you'll be there at the bridge to place these sensors?
September 22nd.
The 22nd, okay. I'm curious to know how much you know about bridge collapses that have already happened. The one that everyone thinks of is the I-35 West span crossing the Mississippi River in Minneapolis.
190 people were on the bridge when it collapsed. By nightfall, 13 were dead.
Looks like the scene at the bridge from the information we have is largely a recovery operation at this time.
This project is funded by the Federal Highway Administration. And as part of the study, we looked at that specific case, the I-35 bridge. We have developed models that showed exactly what happened during the collapse based on reports from the NTSB, based on reports from FHWA. And then we have recreated that whole event in our computers in the lab. And then we assumed what would happen if we had sensors there. That was the scenario that we ran. And we would be able, according to our data that we simulated in the lab, if we had enough sensors placed in the right place there, we'd be able to pick up that event before it happened. We would see that something is wrong that is starting to happen. And if you remember, there was construction over the bridge, so there was something that is different when it comes to traffic. And these sensors would be able to tell you that the stress levels are too high. You have to be careful. Stop whatever you're doing.
So you're testing on the Mackinac Bridge leads me to wonder, why the Mackinac Bridge?
What is best than the iconic Mackinac Bridge in Michigan? So if we're in Michigan, it's like, of course, that's the one that we'll pick. The more technical reason is out-of-plane fatigue, distortion fatigue. It's a problem that we know that exists in all bridges, and it's due to a design that, like a practice that we used to do back in the 80s, the 90s, that MDOT, the Michigan Department of Transportation, has changed in early 2000s, and we are trying to look at that specific problem. So we looked at structures, and the Mackinac Bridge seems to be the best platform to test this kind of things, like the number of components, the length of the bridge, and that was the idea.
Do you envision a future where sensors like these are on every bridge and overpass in the country?
That's our plan, basically. After these tests, if everything is working, everything is successful, we are looking at installing more of them in the hundreds, probably next year in the Mackinac Bridge. We're looking at bridges with the FHWA. We're looking at installing them in the DC area. We have agreements with the state of Virginia to try a couple of sensors there. And everything goes well, and we prove the validity of this technology. I think it will be installed everywhere.
I have to have a little fun with you now and ask you a question about the actual placement of these sensors.
Okay.
On the underside of the Mackinac Bridge. You're going to do it yourself, right?
Yes, with two of my students.
Do you have a personal history of this sort of physical activity, like maybe rock climbing or something like that? Are you a little scared about doing this?
I'm not sure. The only thing I did is bungee jumping from a couple of bridges.
That's more than I've done.
I don't know. I drove over it a couple of times, but we'll see what happens.
Well, I hope you have good weather that day.
Yes, that's the plan. We have a backup date like the next following day on the 23rd, just in case the weather's not that good.
We've been talking with MSU researcher Nizar Lajnev. He's heading to the Mackinac Bridge soon to place sensors on the underside of the Mighty Mack in a project that he hopes will lead to better ways of monitoring the condition of bridges across the country. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And that's Current State for today. Coming up tomorrow, Siblings who grew up on Lansing's east side have played a leading role in development in the area for years now. Pat and Scott Gillespie spent about 10 years working together before forming their own companies. I'll ask the Gillespies what they make of the current development climate and what they love and hate about their work. Plus, it's an ancestor to the piano, and over the past few years, it's been making a comeback. Meet the man from the Flint Institute of Music who teaches how to play this instrument on an upswing. It's the harpsichord. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond, from politics to education, environmental news to healthcare, science and tech, music and theater, stories from around the state and your hometown. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, anyhow, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State from WKAR.